Blog Talk Radio.
Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson, and with me today is my dear friend and co-host, Andre Rodatis. Hi, Andre.
Hi, Paula. Wonderful
we are
hearing
missing...
you.
Yeah, always wonderful to hear your voice, Andre. Dear old friend. We are missing our other dear friend, Crystalyn Beek Larson. She's under the weather today, but we are hoping that she will join us. She said she'll try as soon as possible. And we have, I think, a great show planned, another great series for study of the Urantia book and what it says about various things. And we know it has so much to say about so many things. But today we're starting a series about the 12 Apostles. And the Urantia book is so unique in this respect that it actually gives a personality profile of all 12 of the Apostles. And it's just astonishingly beautiful and touching. And if you've ever read the life and teachings of Jesus from the Urantia book, and you've read this paper 139, you end up falling in love with these men, these 12 men of Galilee, fishermen. And, you know, we knew a lot about them from our biblical understandings of them, but we didn't know all that much. And the Urantia book really brings them home to you in such a way that you feel like, well, like you're one of them. And you feel like you know them and understand them and their human sentiments. And so this paper is really unique and astonishing. And we're going to read it together. We invite you to call in. We'd love to hear from you. We are hoping that our dear friend God's Gumshoe will give us a call here and at a time of his own choosing and that he will shed some biblical insights for us. You know, he's our resident Bible expert. He does a show every Sunday on the Cosmic Citizen called God's Gumshoe Investigates the Bible. And
we've both listened to, and it's a marvelous show. I've learned a great deal about the Bible by listening live or going back to the archive and listening. So wonderful program.
Gumshoe has a really nice experience of both books, the Bible and the Urantia book. And, you know, our dear old friend Dwayne Faw, General Dwayne Faw, used to say, the Urantia
yep.
book make my Bible come alive. And I think anybody who's ever read both books really sees that and appreciates it. And I think the Urantia book actually makes anybody's religious text come alive because
yeah.
it just adds so much to, you know, any religious concepts. It really is holistic that way. So,
you know, and you make an interesting point regarding the Urantia book making things come alive. I just had a conversation with a Urantia book reader very recently where they were indicating how specific papers made the book come alive, that they were the clincher for them. And I think that's different for everybody. I think different people have different papers that sort of are keystone or key in the lock papers for them, that they're the ones that when the reader got to them, things clicked. Well, these 12 apostles papers, there's good folklore around the Urantia book regarding Dr. Sadler and this paper. And I think you know what I'm talking about, Paula.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's a great story.
And you may know it better than I do, and so I will defer to you on anything, but I'll begin it by just saying that this was the clinch paper, by all accounts, for Dr. William S. Sadler on the veracity of the Urantia book. That with his, for those of you that don't know, he was, I believe, the head of the University of Chicago School of Psychology, or maybe Psychiatry, I forget which, at one point. And, I mean, he was a tremendous, psychiatrist in his own right. The real issue with that is that he knew a lot about what made people tick, and also what made people, you know, tick badly or well or whatever. When he came across these profiles of the apostles, they rang so true for him that he realized that the Urantia book had to be what it said it was. Now I don't know how soon or how he actually got to that, and maybe you can fill in the blanks there, but that's how important this paper was to one of the early students of the Urantia book, and one of the linchpins in the Urantia book being here.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was he was the person who fostered these teachings to come through and to be put into book form. And it was a process that took at least 50 years from all of my estimations. They don't know for sure when the phenomena started, probably 1906, or I've heard 1911, but for all accounts and purposes, I'm going to say 1906, which makes the process of the first contact Dr. Sadler had with the sleeping subject, the person we know that was the actual apparatus used to bring the papers through, one man. And this man was brought to Sadler's attention. Now, Sadler was a muckraker of, was a scientist and a true skeptic. And he actually had a hobby of debunking spiritualists and mediums and spiritualism, which was quite big in the early 20th century. And
one might underscore and say spiritualist medium frauds, particularly.
Yeah,
meaning,
right.
Meaning, how many did he find that were not frauds? Two.
Two that he felt like maybe something was happening. And he
yeah.
mentioned them in a book that he wrote, I think it was in 1926, called The Mind at Mischief. Well, by then he was really deeply into the into exploring what was going on with this person and the phenomena that we know as the Urantia Papers. And what's been said is that it was unusual for a mediumship because the voices coming through this individual didn't care what your dead Uncle Charlie had to say or whose horse was going to win in the fifth. You know, it wasn't about that at all. And if you read the Urantia book, you know that what came through was deeply, deeply spiritual and amazing. And I think Sadler was amazed early on, amazed enough to keep his attention for all those many years. I mean, you think about this man spent 70 years investigating this phenomena and died believing that it was absolutely real. Well, the story is that he maintained his skeptical edge right up until the 12 Apostle Papers came through. And so the story goes that the papers would come through, and then Sadler and his family would read them to a group of friends at his office every Sunday afternoon. And there was a group of that group has become known as the Forum, and there was hundreds of people passed through that group. But there was probably, you know, I'm going to guess 50 people there at the time, and.
Very often 70, I think, is what I heard, too.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
70 very
was,
often.
Right, right. And I think it was the main number. But who knows who was there on a given Sunday? You know, were they all there every Sunday? I don't know. But, you know,
right.
He was standing up reading this paper, and he announced to the group, because of who he was, as you pointed out, because he was a psychiatrist and he knew his patients by this time. He knew this fellow that he had been observing all of these years very, very well. He knew quite a bit about him. And he knew that he was no psychologist or psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this paper came through with such spot-on psychological profiles of the 12 apostles, personality profiles, he was just that, that's it, I'm a believer. And he announced this to the group that was present. He announced to them, "Well, that's it. I'm a believer. This is, you know, for me. I can't deny it anymore." And at that point, his wife, who had been engaged and who was also an amazing person in her own right, a doctor in her own right, Lena Celestia Kellogg. She was a Kellogg, one of the Kelloggs of Battle Creek. You know. She jumped up and ran over and threw her arms around him and gave him a big hug and kissed his neck.
Is that right?
Well, because
that's wonderful.
Was already a believer. So
well,
she was
right,
so glad.
Of course, yeah. Yeah, that's
you know.
Amazing.
And concerning these things, I can only say to our audience and our listeners, look, you know, I believe it. I think by now, if you've been listening to me, you and Andre, we both believe it, and Crystalline, she believes it. And the proof is in the pudding. You know, you just have to read it for yourself and decide. I can't convince you. But there's a quality in it, a spiritual flavor that once you read it, I think you'll find, most people who read it do, that it's quite different than anything else you've ever encountered. So,
I used to love Terry Kruger's slogan / T-shirt that he once had printed up. Oh, way back in the 80s. And essentially it was the Urantia book. You've got to read it to believe it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which
reading
is great
is
double
believing.
Entendre on that phrase. It was just wonderful. And it's true. Give it a chance.
I mean,
it's likely
tough
to get under your skin.
Well, and you know, and here's the deal. Truth is for its own sake, and I think what most people don't realize, and something that was told to me when I was just a kid, when I was 16 years old, and it had a tremendously profound effect on my whole life after that. I mean, it was one of those moments. It was one of those pivotal moments in my life where everything changed. And somebody told me a great truth when I was 16, and I was involved with a pretty fundamental religion. And I wasn't involved. I was dabbling. Let's say I was dabbling in it. And my family was concerned about it. And I met a woman that I've never seen before nor since. You know, how sometimes people show up in your life with an important message for you. And she said to me, you know, they call this the truth, and it may or may not be. She said, but you have the ability within you to know the truth when you hear it. And if somebody tells you something and they claim it's the truth, you can decide for yourself if it is or not, and know for yourself if it is or not. And she said, but if it grinds against your natural beliefs, that's the part I'll never forget. She said, the truth shouldn't grind against you. She said, if somebody says something and it grinds against your natural beliefs, don't believe it. It's probably not the truth.
Uh-huh.
And for a person who questions, you know, that was a powerful truth for me. And I went on from there, and I held that belief, and I became a truth seeker, I think, in earnest. Somebody who believed that the truth is out there, and we can all find it. And the first thing that I found that really resonated very deeply with me as being profoundly true was a thing called the Desiderata. And I found it shortly after I had that experience. And, you know, you probably remember it well, but it ends with, you know, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be. And with all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it's still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy. You know, it's just the most beautiful philosophy of living. It had a very profound effect on me. So that's the story of somebody who was set on a search for truth. And when I was 16, I told God, you know, I want to know the truth about you. And by the time I was 20, I had the Urantia book in my hands. And I knew that was the profound answer to my prayer. So we will move on to the 12 Apostles paper. And just so our friends and listeners can be on the same page with us, if you have your Urantia book, it is paper 139 in part 4, The Life and Teachings of Jesus. Andre, do you have the page number in the single column book?
I sure do. It's 1548.
Great.
Is where that starts.
And if you're in the double column book, you can just look up in the corner for the paper 139.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to start reading? Oh, and I should say, too, to our friends and listeners, look, if you want to give us a call, if you have something to share about the 12 Apostles and insight that you've always loved, some information, and like I said, Gumshoe may give us a call and share some biblical information about the 12. The call-in number is 646. I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong number. Oh, no, I didn't. 646.
No, you're right.
716-8158. I'm looking at two numbers here. So, yeah, that's 646-716-8158. Give us a call, and we'll talk about the 12 apostles. So do you want to start, Andre?
I'll be glad to.
Okay.
Paper 139, The 12 Apostles. It is an eloquent testimony to the charm and righteousness of Jesus' earth life that, although he repeatedly dashed to pieces the hopes of his apostles and tore to shreds their every ambition for personal exaltation, only one deserted him. The apostles learned from Jesus about the kingdom of heaven, and Jesus learned much from them about the kingdom of men, human nature as it lives on Urantia and on the other evolutionary worlds of time and space. These 12 men represented many different types of human temperament, and they had not been made alike by schooling. Many of these Galilean fishermen carried heavy strains of Gentile blood as a result of the forcible conversion of the Gentile population of Galilee 100 years previously. Do not make the mistake of regarding the apostles as being altogether ignorant and unlearned. All of them, except the Alpheus twins, were graduates of the synagogue schools, having been thoroughly trained in the Hebrew scriptures and in much of the current knowledge of that day. Seven were graduates of the Capernaum schools, synagogue schools, and there were no better Jewish schools in all Galilee. When your records refer to these messengers of the kingdom as being ignorant and unlearned, it was intended to convey the idea that they were laymen, unlearned in the lore of the rabbis, and untrained in the methods of rabbinical interpretation of the scriptures. They were lacking in so-called higher education. In modern times, they would certainly be considered uneducated, and in some circles of society, even uncultured. One thing is certain. They had not all been put through the same rigid and stereotyped educational curriculum. From adolescence on, they had enjoyed separate experiences of learning how to live.
I find
just
that,
love that.
Yeah. Well, it's intriguing. You know, education, as we know, is a very good thing. But sometimes education is also an indoctrination. And, you know, sometimes the empty glass is the one that can be filled. That's what I get from it, is that they weren't rigidly indoctrinated with some belief system, so much so that they would totally reject Jesus and his brand new way of looking at things.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, they had to respond to, I mean, six of them had to respond directly to wanting to follow him, to being called to follow him in various ways. And it's interesting to go through that part of it as well, to look at how each one of them was called. But there's that other aspect here that I think is an interesting implied criticism of where educational systems, both of that time, but particular of our time, has gone, and that is the idea that they had not been made alike, or they had not been made the same, by being educated in a so common fashion. There's a lot of education today that gets people into a certain kind of a groupthink, where everybody knows kind of the same things, they believe the same things, and they talk about the same things, and you can almost tell who has been to a certain level of academic training, whether it be in the United States or Canada or many first world nations, and tend to believe a lot of things similarly as a result of that education. And what they're indicating is that education did not have the effect of erasing their individuality or character. They had enough character that they retained their individuality, and their education was not such that it was intolerant of different points of view, which says a lot about that. So that's kind of what jumped out at me in that reading. Not to mention
They make it a real point, don't they?
They do,
yeah.
As well as something that, you know, as someone who's not all that well-versed in biblical history, I don't know how well-known it is, and it would be interesting to find this out maybe later from Gumshoe, if he happens to know, whether or not it's generally well known that the Galilean population of 100 years before, of the first century BCE, had been forcibly converted to Judaism. that's something I never knew.
Right. Well, so, you know, he's on the line, so let's put him on.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Hey, Gumshoe.
Hi, Paula.
How are you doing?
Hi, Gigi.
Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen, but that's not until
Thank
tomorrow.
Thank you. Welcome to the Cosmic
Hi,
Citizen yourself.
Yeah, good to hear you.
So good to hear your voice.
Yeah, alive and well.
Good.
Glad to hear that.
Feeling much better?
Yep. The spirit is excited and alive and well. The flesh is recovering. I'm still in recovery mode, but I'm doing well.
Bravo.
Sounds good.
So Andre just threw out a question there about what is known biblically about the apostles and their, were they, how did you put that, Andre? Jewish? We know they were culturally Jewish.
Yeah, they indicate that many of these Galilean fishermen carried heavy strains of Gentile blood as a result of the forcible conversion of the Gentile population of Galilee 100 years previously. Is that well known among biblical scholars?
Yes.
Wonderful. Huh.
A real quick thumbnail sketch is that at one time after King David came in and united the all of the 12 tribes of Israel into one nation called Israel. Then his son Solomon was the builder and built up all of these many of these cities. He fortified these cities against their enemies, the Philistines, and et cetera, et cetera. He also built, of course, the temple in Jerusalem and the palaces and all of the great building time was Solomon. Well, immediately his son, after Solomon, split the country in half so that we had the northern half as Israel and the southern half as Judea or Judah. And in about 710, 720, in and around there, the Assyrians came down. The Assyrians conquered Syria. Then they on the march down, really on their way to Egypt. But they captured and enslaved the northern kingdom of Israel. But they didn't get to the southern kingdom of Judah. That came later with the Babylonians. But in that enslavement, they carried off many of the Hebrew people to Nineveh and into their country. They crossbred, and when they returned, they were more Gentile than Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
And so, now the capital city of the northern part was Samaria.
Oh.
So Samaria, when these people returned and they weren't following the prescribed Hebrew traditions, well, they became heretics and the kind of outcasts. And so the southern kingdom were always slightly snobbish about how they were the people who were following the correct commandments, the correct word of God. And in the Bible, in the Old Testament, you have the good kings and the bad kings, and almost all of the bad kings are in the northern part, and the good kings are in the southern part. Good prophets and bad prophets, the same thing. It's basically those guys up there are black magic, and we're with the white magic.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of where much of this happened. In and around 167 B.C. is called the Maccabean Revolt. And at about that time, the Palestine was under the control of one of the generals of Alexander the Great. And he was a tremendous sadist and a really unpleasant person. So he would do things like sacrifice a pig on the altar in the temple and a number of really outrageously things where he was really trying to turn the cities of the Eastern Mediterranean into Greek cities. Everything Greek was the call. And the Hebrews and the Israelites were were extremely opposed to this. And in and around 167, the Maccabeans rose up and kicked these guys out of the country. They called on the Romans to come and help, and that didn't turn out to be such a good idea. And then the Romans stayed. But what they when they did push them north, they pushed a lot of them into Galilee, and that's where they stayed. And so there was a lot of intertribal marriage and what would be called, I guess, crossbreeding. And so that was, I think that's the reference that you're making. Capernaum was a very large center. It had a large synagogue. And in and around those times, the synagogues were not just like what we consider a church. They were a community center where they taught the boys the scriptures. The rabbis there taught. That was school. They had community meetings. They pretty much hung out in and around the synagogues. And Capernaum was one of the largest, one of the most prominent ones that in that area at that time, and was recognized as one of the best schools. In our program on Sundays, back a few episodes, in fact, a few more episodes, and we'll have some more. We have some clips of the archaeologists who are actually unearthing these synagogues and homes in Capernaum. And it was a particularly prosperous area, primarily because the fish from the Sea of Galilee were freshwater fish, pickled, smoked, dried, and distributed both east and west. So east out into Damascus, Syria, and onto the camel trails going east into what's now would be Iran and Afghanistan and India, and then west into the Roman Empire. And it was a huge delicacy all the way through the Roman Empire. And so it was big business. It was as big as anything in sort of relation that we've got going today with our big, huge corporations. This was big business. They had, when we see pictures of Jesus walking along the seashores of Capernaum and Bethsaida, we see these boats sort of in the water, but they had huge rock wave protection systems and ports all along those two cities. Or, well, Bethsaida was more a kind of a bedroom community in Capernaum was almost like a Mediterranean seaport. So these fellows who came out of Capernaum, at the Capernaum schools, were well educated as far as one could be in that day. They were the best in well, there wasn't very much in the way of in Samaria, but in the northern half of Palestine.
Would it be safe to say that the apostles and the folks in Galilee and Capernaum were what we might term middle class?
Oh yeah, yes, absolutely.
So kind of solidly middle class.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, the middle class really only existed in kind of the urban areas, and then it wasn't very big. Mm-hmm. There were the rich, the poor, and there was a few tradesmen in between. But in and around Galilee, it was had a very strong agricultural base. So they had all kinds of agricultural products, and then of course the fish, and mining. They had a lot of mines, although most of the real rich mines were south in the southern part of Judah, actually. But yeah, they it was going concern. It was all kinds of industry and commercial business going through, and of course it was the trade routes between east and west.
So I'm really happy to have that insight about the fishing industry there, because it's something that I never thought of obviously they were all fishermen they weren't all fishermen, but many of them were. And Jesus was. And Jesus was also known as the boat builder of Capernaum. And he built a beautiful you know, he redesigned some of the boats that just took over the sea. Really, they were so far superior to anything that the Sea of Galilee had at the time. But, you know, it's interesting to think about what a bustling trade that might have been, and then why, if they ran out of funds, if the Apostolic Corps ran out of funds, they could just go back to their nets and pretty easily replenish. That makes perfect sense to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty easy. Well, and particularly as John and James Zebedee's father, who was Zebedee of Bethsaida, he was a big time packing house for the fishing industry. So he was a very wealthy and influential man in and around Northern Galilee, and so. Whenever they needed to sell their fish, they had a ready market for it. He'd buy everything they
could. Is that biblically known, too? Is that information about?
Not much, but I think it's in, let me think. With this concussion in my head, I lost a few of my marbles.
he was a boat builder, though, too, right? Zebedee built boats on Galilee, right.
Yeah, I think it's in Luke. I think that this particular situation is in Luke where Jesus walks up to James and John Zebedee and says, "Follow me," whereby they got out of the boat and left their father sitting in the boat. So it's well known that their father was often in the boats also, keeping a kind of a hands-on, hands-on owner-operator of his business.
And we know from the Urantia book that James and John and the whole Zebedee family was very dear to Jesus, and he spent quite a bit of time with that family. He was almost like, you know, a brother in that family. They loved him dearly. They thought the world of him.
Well, Salome, which was, according to the Urantia book, Salome, which was Zebedee's wife, wrote a letter of reference and introduction and recommendation to the high priest in Jerusalem on behalf of Jesus, that Jesus carried with him when he went down, before his baptism, when he went down to have a look at the rabbinical schools and things like that. So Salome, and in that letter she wrote, "This is Joshua, who I treat as and understand and love as a son." Mm-hmm. So she was not shy about saying, "This boy means a lot to me. Look after him."
Yeah, right. And she must have had some influence herself for her letter to have carried weight, which it
I meant which this high priest was her. I think it was her brother.
Mm-hmm,
yeah,
right.
I think it was her brother. Yeah. So she had a lot of pull. And I think it's I don't think it was Annas, but it sounds like. Maybe, as I say, I lost a few marbles, but back in the summer here. He was high. He was very high in the priesthood. He was a part of the Sanhedrin and very high in the hierarchy of the temple.
She was well connected.
He was one of
the
temple
tycoons. Yeah, right.
Say it again.
Do you remember Salome's relative? What he actually was?
It's
very coming to mind
after the fact. Yeah. He became instrumental after the fact when Jesus was having all of the difficulties with the Sanhedrin. He stepped up on behalf of Jesus, but it to no avail.
Mm-hmm, right. Well, let's continue on then. Gumshoe, can you hang on here with us for a while?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Sure.
That's wonderful.
Love to. Yeah, you know where we are. We're on paper 139, and we're reading section one now, Andrew, the first chosen.
Interestingly enough, I'm just completing tomorrow my four-part series on the apostles.
Yay.
So tomorrow I'm 140, I think page 140, 140 in the ordination ceremony, which is the Beatitudes. In the Bible, it's called the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount. And
right.
So tomorrow, we're going to ordain these fellows. So this is,
well, you know,
we're really on the same page, aren't we?
I know, and it's funny because Andre for years was a member of our group in Boulder until he left to go up to Montreal in the just last several months. And we are exactly in this very place. I mean, we have been reading in the last few weeks the 12 Apostle Papers. So it must be a timely thing. You know, I find when the Spirit moves, we're kind of all, those of us who are responsive to it, all get on the same page.
I think we must all be at the same production meeting.
Yeah. That's right.
Spiritual production meeting. We're all working on the same papers. That's great. It's great. And, of course, we're following it with the Bible. So,
we know who the boss is. So he's guiding this.
Amen.
He's guiding this. So Amen. This is where we are, paper 139, section 1. Andrew, the first chosen, I'll read this one. Andrew, chairman of the apostolic core of the kingdom, was born in Capernaum. He was the oldest child in a family of five, himself, his brother Simon, and three sisters. His father, now dead, had been a partner of Zebedee in the fish-drying business at Bethsaida. There you go, Gumshoe. The first harbor of Capernaum. When he became an apostle, Andrew was unmarried, but made his home with his married brother, Simon Peter. Both were fishermen and partners of James and John, the sons of Zebedee. In A.D. 26, the year he was chosen as an apostle, Andrew was 33, a full year older than Jesus and the oldest of the apostles. He sprang from an excellent line of ancestors and was the ablest man of the 12. Excepting oratory, he was a peer of his associates in almost every imaginable ability. Jesus never gave Andrew a nickname, a fraternal designation. But even as the apostles soon began to call Jesus Master, so they also designated Andrew by a term the equivalent of chief. Andrew was a good organizer, but a better administrator. He was one of the inner circle of the four apostles. But his appointment by Jesus as the head of the apostolic group made it necessary for him to remain on duty with his brethren, while the other three enjoyed a very close communion with the Master. To the very end, Andrew remained dean of the apostolic group. Although Andrew was never an effective preacher, he was an efficient personal worker, being the pioneer missionary of the kingdom in that, as the first chosen apostle, he immediately brought to Jesus his brother Simon, who subsequently became one of the greatest preachers of the kingdom. Andrew was the chief supporter of Jesus' policy of utilizing the program of personal work as a means of training the 12 as messengers of the kingdom. Whether Jesus privately taught the apostles or preached to the multitude, Andrew was usually conversant with what was going on. He was an understanding executive and an efficient administrator. He rendered a prompt decision on every matter brought to his notice, unless he deemed the problem was beyond the domain of his authority, in which event he would take it straight to Jesus. Andrew and Peter were very unlike in character and temperament. But it must be recorded everlastingly to their credit that they got along together splendidly. Andrew was never jealous of Peter's oratorical ability. Not often will an older man of Andrew's type be observed exerting such a profound influence over a younger and talented brother. Andrew and Peter never seemed to be in the least jealous of each other's abilities or achievements. Late on the evening of the day of Pentecost, when, largely through the enigmatic and inspiring preaching of Peter, 2,000 souls were added to the kingdom, Andrew said to his brother, "I could not do that, but I am glad I have a brother who could." To which Peter replied, "And but for your bringing me to the Master, and by your steadfast keeping me with him, I should not have been here to do this." Andrew and Peter were the exceptions to the rule, proving that even brothers can live together peaceably and work together effectively. After Pentecost, Peter was famous, but it never irritated the older Andrew to spend the rest of his life being introduced as Simon Peter's brother. Of all the apostles, Andrew was the best judge of men. He knew that trouble was brewing in the heart of Judas Iscariot, even when none of the others suspected that anything was wrong with their treasurer. But he told none of them these fears. Andrew's great service to the kingdom was in advising Peter, James, and John concerning the choice of the first missionaries who were sent out to proclaim the gospel, and also in counseling these early leaders about the organization of the administrative affairs of the kingdom. Andrew had a great gift for discovering the hidden resources and latent talents of young people. Very soon after Jesus' ascension on high, Andrew began the writing of a personal record of many of the sayings and doings of his departed master. After Andrew's death, other copies of this private record were made and circulated freely among the early teachers of the Christian church. These informal notes of Andrew's were subsequently edited, amended, altered, and added to until they made up a fairly consecutive narrative of the Master's life on earth. The last of these few altered and amended copies was destroyed by fire at Alexandria about 100 years after the original was written by the first chosen of the 12 apostles. Andrew was a man of clear insight, logical thought, and firm decision, whose great strength of character consisted in his superb stability, his temperamental handicap, enthusiasm. He many times failed to encourage those. And this reticence to praise the worthy accomplishments of his friends grew out of his abhorrence of flattery and insincerity. Andrew was one of those all-round, even-tempered, self-made, and successful men of modest affairs. Every one of the apostles loved Jesus, but it remains true that each of the 12 was drawn toward him because of some certain trait of personality which made a special appeal to the individual apostle. Andrew admired Jesus because of his consistent sincerity, his unaffected dignity. When men once knew Jesus, they were possessed with the urge to share him with their friends. They really wanted all the world to know him. When the later persecutions finally scattered the apostles from Jerusalem, Andrew journeyed through Armenia, Asia Minor, and Macedonia, and, after bringing many thousands into the kingdom, he was finally apprehended and crucified in Patrae in Achaia. It was two full days before this robust man expired on the cross, and throughout these tragic hours, he continued effectively the salvation of the kingdom of heaven.
Well, what an end of life, huh?
Well, that's our brother Andrew. And you
that's
know,
amazing.
I know. You know, and to me, this paper really exemplifies the beauty of the language and the writing of the Urantia book. And what really, you know, obviously Andrew was a special person and very capable and able to do exactly the task that Jesus gave to him, and that's being the chief of the apostolic corps. But this section really touched me deeply when it said, when once men knew Jesus, they were possessed with the urge to share him with their friends. They really wanted all the world to know him. You know, that makes my heart swell to read that, because that in a nutshell is how I feel. After having read The Life and Teachings of Jesus in the Urantia book, I would just love everybody to read it just one time and know this master, this magnificent, beloved human being, this ambassador from on high, this, you know, embodiment of peace. The apostles called him Master Unbidden, and when you read about him in this book, the only thing it seems appropriate to call him is Master, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Just Sovereign, Lord. I think when people call him Lord, that's what they mean. They mean Master. It's another way of saying Master. So what are your thoughts on this section, Andre, and Gumshoe?
Well, there's just a couple of things that come up for me, and I'll be brief, and then I'm really interested in what Gigi has to say, because I'm sure that he's got some insights. But two things come to mind, and one is, just again what they're alluding to with Jesus, just to dovetail on your comment. The Jesus of the Urantia book is an approachable Jesus. I'm not saying that the Jesus of mainline or Christianity is not approachable necessarily, but he's not necessarily approachable given some of the teachings that are there in the various sects of Christianity, some of them. Let's put it this way. In some sects, he's more approachable than others. The Jesus of the Urantia book is entirely approachable because you get the full humanity of Jesus being revealed in the Urantia book in a way that you don't get in sort of the vignettes that are available elsewhere. So I encourage anybody that hasn't read through part four of the Urantia book to do so, to really get, to be really taken hold by this this Jesus that is presented in the Urantia book. It's a Jesus you can't help but fall in love with because he's made so real. The second thing is, what I'm struck with my own early history regarding Andrew and the apostles, and I wouldn't have remembered this somehow except for some of the other comments that we'd made. I grew up Roman Catholic, and we had this big, huge Catholic Bible that had pictures and things, and it had a section. In fact, I have that Bible, and unfortunately, I didn't even think to open it up for this program, but I might do it in a subsequent program, because as a kid, you know, we were learning about all kinds of things about Jesus' life and everything in catechism, and one thing was about the private life of Jesus, which I think I've shared on a previous show, that when I heard about that, it inspired me to pray, to ask, to know the private life of Jesus, and little did I know that I would be presented with the Urantia book, which tells us about those quote-unquote hidden or lost or private years of Jesus between 12 and approximately 30. What struck me was, in this Catholic Bible, there were these 12 sections on the apostles. Profiles, just like what we're getting here. But they weren't real profiles or full profiles. They were just, again, based on what little could be gleaned from biblical history and what was there. When I read through this, I really get a sense of who this man was. I never would have known, except for this reading, you know, what a leader Andrew was. Mm-hmm. How he was a man of ability, it always did seem like he was a lesser apostle compared to Peter in terms of any depiction in Catholicism or Christianity in general, as far as I could tell. So there wasn't that much known except he was Simon Peter's brother. This really fleshes it out, and you really get the sense, given what's being said about him, why it is he might have been chosen to lead the apostles if he really did have all that ability. And I'll end with this. I'm particularly impressed with this one statement because it's not only revealing of Andrew as an apostle, it's revealing of a way to psychologically profile somebody that is highly, highly unusual. And it was this line here. It was the line that said, it was the line in paragraph 8 of that section, of all the apostles, Andrew was the best judge of men. And yes, he knew that trouble was brewing in the heart of Judas Iscariot. So immediately you get the idea that here he's the one apostle that has perhaps some deeper insight and some intuition into people. But it's this last sentence. Andrew had a great gift for discovering the hidden resources and latent talents of young people. I find that fascinating as a psychological profile. That, number one, it's being revealed that it can be a gift of personality that you may have the ability to discover the hidden resources and latent talents of young people, or put maybe a little more generally, that you might have the insight to be able to pick out what is hidden, maybe even from those people to themselves, maybe what's hidden from those people to others, and see what those talents are, and maybe even then to bring them out of them. I find that fascinating. And it expands the whole idea of what personality can be, because God knows what we've all been given in our own personalities that we might be able to explore. And when we're given this kind of a profile of Andrew and his character and personality, it gives us a sense of just how rich personality might be. And at least in some of these aspects, it's like a glimpse of what might be there that we don't even see in ourselves, that God, you know, our thought adjuster, the angels, and a host of celestial beings are waiting to educate out of us, or bring out of us is really what I mean to say. And with that, I'd like to ask Gumshoe to add his commentary, but let me, since we're here at the 1 o'clock hour practically in the Eastern time zone, let me just say that you're listening to The Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio, and today's episode is on the 12 Apostles of Jesus of Nazareth, a four-part series, and this is part one, and we're talking about the Apostle Andrew. So what can you tell us about this, Gigi?
A couple of things, I think. First of all, can I just go back for just a minute? I'll just push the pause button on that for 1 minute. Zebedee's wife, Salome, it says in the Urantia book on paper 129, was a relative of Annas.
Oh, good.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you.
One-time high priest of Jerusalem and still the most influential of the Sadducee group, having been deposed only 8 years previously. She sent a letter of reference and in it to Annas, the former high priest, Annas, and stated in there, this is Jesus, quote, one, the same as my own son.
Mm.
So there, that clears that part up. Just an aside to what Andre had just mentioned about Andrew having this insight into young people. It tells us that Andrew was the eldest, and so was Jesus. And so both of them were the head of their household. And Andrew had brother Simon, or Jesus later named Peter, and I think he said three sisters. So as the head of the household and kind of the individual responsible for making decisions in the Jewish household, he would have probably had great insight into young people and their needs and desires and wants and how best to approach them. The other thing that I think is quite interesting is that there are two people at the Urantia Papers come out as the best kept secrets of Christianity. One of them is Rodin, who was a Greek philosopher in Alexandria, whose disciples, who spent some time in Jesus' camp and then sent his disciples into Jerusalem, and they really started the movement of Christianity. It was one of his disciples, Stephen, who was first stoned and first martyred. So the Urantia Papers, when they bring forward some information, it just fills and expands what we already know. And one of them is the situation with Andrew. Scholars have known for decades that the Gospels were leaning on, particularly Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the Synoptic Gospels, were leaning on another source. And I think it must have been in the early 20s, a group of German scholars, textual critics, had determined that this source must have been sayings, because they could look in the books of particularly Matthew and Luke, and they could see that they had the sayings word for word, phrase for phrase, in the right sequence with each other, and they knew that they must have had another source, and they called that source the Q document, which meant Quelle or Quell.
What
did
it mean?
Which is a German word that means source.
And what did it mean, Domshu?
It means source. The source
Q,
document.
But you said another word that where Q.
Oh, Quella. Yeah. Quella. Quella.
Okay.
It's German. The German word for source.
Okay.
So this became very, very important to textual critics who began to look at the story of Jesus as told by these apostles. And I think that this is one of the most important things that we can have our viewers to understand, particularly Urantia Book readers, is that for 2,000 years, the only story that we had about this incredible human being, Jesus, who was also a divine being, was from the New Testament. And the only reason we have that New Testament is because these apostles wrote it down. So to know who these apostles are and their contribution is exceedingly important in also knowing and understanding Jesus. Well, Andrew, the Urantia Papers tell us, was the source of this Q document, although it had been modified and there was only sort of bits and pieces. So Matthew had a kind of a version of it. It got copied and recopied and copied and recopied, and lots of errors and mistakes in it, but mostly it contained the sayings of Jesus, although it did have some philosophical ideas that have flowed into the Gospels and through into Christianity. And the Urantia Papers tell us that it was Andrew that was the source of that Q document, that Matthew had written his story in about the 40 AD or so, and it kind of kept it. But on his death, it moved to Isidore, and then at the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, he fled to Pella, which is somewhere between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, to a town where most of the Pentecost is the birthplace, but really where the Christian community started coming together after the destruction of Jerusalem, they fled to Pella, where most of the apostles, or many of the apostles, did. And Isidore, that's where Isidore wrote the gospel according to Matthew. And he had Matthew's document. He had some jottings and some other stories, and he had this Q document. Luke, later, coming from it from the other side, after traveling around with Paul, picked up the Q document probably at Antioch. So he got a version of it. And remarkably, they dovetail nicely in the New Testament. So Andrew's contribution is anonymous, for the most part, or has been up until now, for all these, for 2,000 years. And he's still the leader. he's still exercising, albeit in a document that's been changed, he's still exercising a leadership in the Christian movement through his writing.
I found that absolutely fascinating. I do, too. And I love that you brought that up, and I love the fact that Andrew, because we all know Andrews in our lives. They're the people that are willing to work behind the scenes, and they're integral. They're irreplaceable. No matter what we endeavor to do, they add their diligence and their abilities, and they don't need to be rewarded. They don't need to be recognized. They don't need the accolades, but they are instrumental. They are the linchpins that hold everything together, the glue. And, you know, it's touching to me that being who he was, he abhorred in sincerity. Well, that makes sense, because he didn't need to get any recognition. He did what he did out of a heart of service and love. And he was able to say to his brother, I'm glad you could do that. And, you know, myself and my sister have the same relationship. My sister's who is no longer in this world. She's moved on to greener pastures, let's say, but she was the kind of person who was a shy person and unassuming. And I'm the boisterous, ham of the family. But she and I got on so well. And she so admired my abilities, and I so admired her. So I can really appreciate these two brothers who complimented one another. And, you know, the Urantia book says that angels always come in pairs, aggressive and retiring. And I have found that the best marriages are similar, because when you have those two complementary positions, neither one competes with the other. They both know what they're good at, and they both work together to complete the other. And it's just neat. I admire so much people like Andrew, who work behind the scenes and make things happen. And, you know, my own husband has said, you know, because I have a reputation in the Urantia movement, I've been at the end of an 800 number for a very long time. And my husband will go to a Urantia conference with me, and people will ask him who he is, and he'll say, I'm Mr. Paula Thompson. and there's immediate recognition, you know. And he's fine with that. He's a classic shy person. And he's the kind of person that works behind the scenes. He told me once, my gift to the revelation is to stay home and hold down the fort so that you can do what you do. Awesome. Awesome thing.
Well, yes, he and behind such a great woman, there must be a really great guy. You know?
It's a great guy.
Yeah, he is. He's a terrific guy. I love it every time I get a chance to see him. Yeah, and he is quiet. He's quiet. You would never, you know, suspect that he's such a big support. But he is. He's a huge support to you. I know he is. So.
Yeah, I couldn't do. He's been so good for my magnificent obsession with the mm-hmm. adventure book. So, you know, my hat's off to Andrew and to you, Glenn. Wherever you are, you're up in the mountains hunting for a big bull elk right now, and I hope you get one.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
It's hunting season everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. So, well, let's move on. We started with Andrew. Let's go to his little brother, the great orator of the movement of Jesus' apostles, Simon Peter. Do you want to read that, Gumshoe? Are you up for reading? Or
not? No. My glasses don't seem to work since I had this rafter fall on my head, so I'm still picking up the marbles.
Well, just so people know, we've made reference to it. Gumshoe was at work in his carpenter shop last summer, and a rafter fell on his head, and he received an injury that was quite serious. And so our prayers have been with you, and you sound great, and I'm so glad you're here. And
yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Spirit is
very
happy
nice to have you.
Precious recovery.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks,
there
guys.
You go.
Thanks. Thanks. Thank you for your prayers. I really felt it, and I'm certain that it's helped considerably.
Yeah. Prayer power.
Prayer power.
Okay, Andre. Yeah. Well, you take it away then with Simon Peter.
I guess I could, but do we have somebody else on the line already?
Well, we do, and she's waiting to. She's going to put up her hand when she's ready to come on. Our pal,
okay.
Crystalline.
All right.
Says, oh, look, here she is. She just put up her hand.
Oh, for goodness sake. And we flushed her out of the bushes. There we go.
We did. It's the spirit.
Hi,
hello,
Christy.
Hello there. Hello there.
Hey,
I actually have been pushing one for quite a long time, and it just wasn't responding for some reason.
Hmm. Well, see, everything in God's time, I guess. Your it just now came up.
So, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Chris.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Yeah. So do you
well,
feel
I'll,
free,
I'll be glad.
Or Andre,
yeah,
are you
I'd be happy to.
Okay. All right. And we have another caller waiting, so after we're done reading Simon Peter, we can take another caller.
All right. Simon Peter. When Simon joined the apostles, he was 30 years of age. He was married, had 3 children, and lived at Bethsaida near Capernaum. His brother Andrew and his wife's mother lived with him. Both Peter and Andrew were fisher partners of the sons of Zebedee. The master had known Simon for some time before Andrew presented him as the second of the apostles. When Jesus gave Simon the nickname Peter, he did it with a smile. It was to be a sort of nickname. Simon was well known to all his friends as an erratic and impulsive fellow. True, later on, Jesus did attach a new and significant import to this lightly bestowed nickname. Simon Peter was a man of impulse, an optimist. He had grown up permitting himself freely to indulge strong feelings. He was constantly getting into difficulties because he persisted in speaking without thinking. This sort of thoughtlessness also made incessant trouble for all his friends and associates and was the cause of his receiving many mild rebukes from his master. The only reason Peter did not get into more trouble because of his thoughtless speaking was that he very early learned to talk over many of his plans and schemes with his brother Andrew before he ventured to make public proposals. Peter was a fluent speaker, eloquent and dramatic. He was also a natural and inspirational leader of men, a quick thinker, but not a deep reasoner. He asked many questions, more than all the apostles put together, and while the majority of these questions were good and relevant, many of them were thoughtless and foolish. Peter did not have a deep mind, but he knew his mind fairly well. He was therefore a man of quick decision and sudden action, While others talked in their astonishment at seeing Jesus on the beach, Peter jumped in and swam ashore to meet the Master. The one trait which Peter most admired in Jesus was his supernal tenderness. Peter never grew weary of contemplating Jesus' forbearance. He never forgot the lesson about forgiving the wrongdoer, not only 7 times, but 70 times in 7. He thought much about these impressions of the Master's forgiving character during those dark and dismal days immediately following his thoughtless and unintended denial of Jesus in the high priest's courtyard. Simon Peter was distressingly vacillating. He would suddenly swing from one extreme to the other. First, he refused to let Jesus wash his feet, and then, on hearing the Master's reply, begged to be washed all over. But after all, Jesus knew that Peter's faults were of the head and not of the heart. He was one of the most inexplicable combinations of courage and cowardice that ever lived on earth. His great strength of character was loyalty, friendship. Peter really and truly loved Jesus. And yet, despite this towering strength of devotion, he was so unstable and inconstant that he permitted a servant girl to tease him into denying his Lord and Master. Peter could withstand persecution and any other form of direct assault, but he withered and shrank before ridicule. He was a brave soldier when facing a frontal attack, but was a fear-cringing coward when surprised with an assault from the rear. Peter was the first of Jesus' apostles to come forward to defend the work of Philip among the Samaritans and Paul among the Gentiles. Yet later on at Antioch, he reversed himself when confronted by ridiculing Judaizers, temporarily withdrawing from the Gentiles, only to bring down upon his head the fearless denunciation of Paul. He was the first one of the apostles to make wholehearted confession of Jesus' combined humanity and divinity, and the first, save Judas, to deny him. Peter was not so much of a dreamer, but he disliked to descend from the clouds of ecstasy and the enthusiasm of dramatic indulgence to the plain and matter-of-fact world of reality. In following Jesus, literally and figuratively, he was either leading the procession or else trailing behind, following afar off. But he was the outstanding preacher of the 12. He did more than any other one man, aside from Paul, to establish the kingdom and send its messengers to the four corners of the earth in one generation. After his rash denials of the Master, he found himself, and with Andrew's sympathetic and understanding guidance, he again led the way back to the fishnet while the apostles tarried to find out what was to happen after the crucifixion. When he was fully assured that Jesus had forgiven him, and knew he had been received back into the Master's fold, the fires of the kingdom burned so brightly within his soul that he became a great and saving light to thousands who sat in darkness. After leaving Jerusalem and before Paul became the leading spirit among the Gentile Christian churches, Peter traveled extensively, visiting all the churches from Babylon to Corinth. He even visited and ministered to many of the churches which had been raised up by Paul. Although Peter and Paul differed much in temperament and education, even in theology, they worked together harmoniously for the upbuilding of the churches during their later years. Something of Peter's style and teaching is shown in the sermons partially recorded by Luke, and then the Gospel of Mark. His vigorous style was better shown in his letter known as the First Epistle of Peter. At least this was true before it was subsequently altered by a disciple of Paul. But Peter persisted in making the mistake of trying to convince the Jews that Jesus was, after all, really and truly the Jewish Messiah. Right up to the day of his death, Simon Peter continued to suffer confusion in his mind between the concepts of Jesus as the Jewish Messiah, Christ as the world's Redeemer, and the Son of Man as the revelation of God, the loving Father of all mankind. Peter's wife was a very able woman. For years, she labored acceptably as a member of the women's corps. And when Peter was driven out of Jerusalem, she accompanied him upon all his journeys to the churches, as well as on all his missionary excursions. And the day her illustrious husband yielded up his life, she was thrown to the wild beasts in the arena at Rome.
Well,
and
I
so
wanna,
this
I,
man... Go
oh,
ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead. I thought you were finished. Go ahead.
And so this man, Peter, an intimate of Jesus, one of the inner circle, went forth from Jerusalem proclaiming the glad tidings of the kingdom with power and glory until the fullness of his ministry had been accomplished. And he regarded himself as the recipient of high honors when his captors informed him that he must die as his master had died on the cross. And thus was Simon Peter crucified in Rome.
You know, I want to do a cross-reference with this, too, because this is what the midwayers tell us about Simon Peter. The significance of this remarkable doing can the better be understood when we record the fact that out of this group of 32 Jesus-taught religious leaders in Rome, only two were unfruitful. The 30 became pivotal leaders in the establishment of Christianity in Rome. And certain of them who aided in turning the chief Mithraic temple into the first Christian church of that city, we who view human activities from behind the scenes and in the light of 20 centuries now of time recognize just three factors of paramount value in the early setting of the stage for the rapid spread of Christianity throughout Europe, and they are: 1. The choosing and holding of Simon Peter as an apostle. 2. The talk in Jerusalem with Stephen, whose death led to the winning of Saul of Tarsus, Paul. And 3. The preliminary preparation of these 30 Romans for the subsequent leadership of the new religion in Rome throughout the empire. That's from paper 132, The Sojourn at Rome, and Jesus' preliminary work in his private ministry when he toured the Mediterranean. So, you know, I love that because Peter and Paul are listed by the midwayers as the most important factors for the spreading of Christianity throughout the world.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he was I'm just amazed at what his ability must have been. And, you know, it's one thing to hear that somebody's a good public speaker. It's another thing to actually hear that public speaking.
Oh, yeah.
And to witness it and to understand it. And if you know good public speaking, and I've been privileged to witness some very, very good public speaking, it's amazing what a good public speaker can do to turn an audience you know, in favor of whatever it is that they're talking about and how eloquent they are. And apparently he had that kind of eloquence, and what a remarkable thing that might have been to witness.
It sounds like he was bipolar. I'm kidding.
That could be true.
Huh. He did have those two natures. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we have a caller who's been holding for a while. Let's put him on and see what he has to say. This is Neshamaya, I believe, if I'm pronouncing it right. Hello, friend. You're with us on Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, good morning. I was listening into the show a little bit. And I've seen the Aranta book on a few occasions. And one of the things I wanted to know is this. I mean, in reading the scriptures, one of the things that I see as an utmost message, really from Genesis to Revelation, the same message I see ultimately, is something that I don't hear oftentimes spoken in so, let's just say, most institutionalized circles, if you know what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
So-called religious institutionalized circles. Reading the scriptures from Genesis to Revelation, all the way from the time of the garden forward, one of the things that I keep seeing over and over again as a recurring theme is that all prophecy relates that once man turned away from the pure and perfect will of the One, turned away from that message that he gives on high to, let's just say, man turning toward a multitude of his own presumptuous ideals. Oftentimes, once he got off track, let's just say, wanted to continue on his own track rather than, you know, turning back toward what the initial reality is, like when the scripture says, in the beginning was the Word. Word with God, Word with God. In other words, an eternal constancy. One of the things that I see as a constant throughout the scriptures is the hope of a promise that one day, beyond all these, I looked it up recently, some 45,000 denominations in the world and some 280-odd nations in the world, one day the Most High would send his Messiah for the, or his Savior, if you will, for the express purpose to end all this confusion whereby a whole world would be reconciled unto himself. And that makes a lot of sense because it's not possible that a multitude of differing ideas and doctrines be his promise or his covenant. And what I was wondering, when I see that premise throughout the book, which basically means to me that for all we think we know, the prophecies say that there's, let's just say, some decided elements of foundational truth that have been ignored. I was wondering what the Aranta book says about this. Because one of the things that I found is this, that amazing as it may seem to most people, reading the Bible very closely, it's amazing to find out that the prophecies don't really say the Messiah comes one or two times, but ultimately three, if you look at Isaiah very closely. It talks about him coming a second time to regather Israel as he gathered Israel before. And the only other occasion you see Israel regathered out of a, let's just say, the confusion of the nations before was under Cyrus the Great, amazingly enough, who the scriptures call Messiah. One of the things I wanted to know is this. What does the Aranta book intimate, if anything, with regard to when Christ said, for instance, in Revelation 22:16, I'm the root and offspring of David, the bright and morning star. Morning star, the morning sun. Luke 1:78 calls him sunrise. Ker meaning sun, tis meaning rise. Coming back with that same connotation over and over again. And that was the father of John the Baptist who said it. So here's my question. What in the Aranta book intimates any of this? Because it sounds amazing, I know, to most people in contemporary religion to even talk about that. But I'll just give you another example. Revelation 16.
You've asked a lot of questions, and yeah. if we're to answer any of these questions or any part of your question, we might want to go ahead and just begin to do so. I appreciate your curiosity.
Yeah.
Your curiosity about that.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Gumshoe, you're a resident Bible expert here. Yeah,
well,
you're on.
Well, okay. Well, thank you very much for the kind words, but I prefer investigator. Yes, I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, and your volume on your telephone was a little off for my ears, but I think I have the gist of what you're you're asking, and I want to thank you for that question. That's an excellent question. It's one that comes up for many Bible or for people who have that biblical perspective on our show, which is on Sundays, when we sort of compare the Bible and the Urantia Papers together with the scholastic view. And I think that one of the things that I learned very quickly when I was first coming to the Urantia Papers about 40 years ago was, and what I learned also in the seminary in studying the Bible, was that the Bible can really be summed up in three words, both New Testament and Old Testament. And those three words are put God first. All of the prophets, all of the teachers, all of the rabbis, all of the masters, all of the teachers basically said something that would closely resemble that. Put God first.
Something like the first command.
Just as Jesus came and expanded on the revelation that was, let's call it the Old Testament, the Urantia Papers have come now to expand on that revelation that we now call the Old Testament. And if we were to sum up the Urantia book, I'm not sure that everybody would agree with this, but I think that you could probably say the same thing, that the Urantia Papers tell us over and over and over again, seek first the kingdom of heaven and all things will be added to you. That put God first. And that all that the papers are doing is expanding the knowledge that we already have, filling in some of the discrepancies that we didn't know, such as this information about Andrew being the source of the Q document, and continuing with that revelation, telling us that the sooner and the quicker and the better that we put God first in every decision, in every choice, in every moment of our day, when we do it God's way instead of our way, our life gets better. And that the kingdom of heaven is this place within us that we make these decisions. And when we seek God's will, God's way, God's help in our day-to-day, minute-to-minute decisions and choices that we make in a day, we will always know the truth. The truth will always set us free, and your life will get better. And I think, in essence, that those three books, the Old Testament, or the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, the New Covenant, and now the Urantia Papers, are just expanding and expanding our knowledge. Now, as to the coming of Jesus, no man knows the hour or the day or the time. But the Urantia Papers say that it needs to be prepared. The world needs to be prepared for something like this, and the Urantia Papers are one more step in bringing that possibility closer.
Hmm. Well,
can I also add my 2 cents in, too?
Absolutely.
I also think that one of the things that the Urantia book does is it really expands what our expectation is for the future, in that it says that, you know, we are at some point in the future, probably the fairly distant future, we will be settled in what they refer to as the age of light and life, where the whole world is unified. Not uniformity in terms of all believing exactly the same thing, but is unified in purpose, in the purpose of a religious concept of wanting to do the Father's will. And this will be what we would consider the age of utopia.
Hmm.
And that this is going to follow, we believe, the coming of the second coming of Jesus.
Hmm. Hello?
Would you agree with me, folks?
Yes. Yes.
And so I think that the concepts of Jesus as the Messiah in some ways are correct, and the concept of Jesus as the deliverer is also in some ways, correct. But Jesus himself says that the real reason for him coming is as the Son of Man, as the revelation of God, the revelation of God to man, and the revelation of man to God. It's his experience of living life as a, one of his creatures to fully be able to rule in wisdom and in authority. So he will have experienced what it's like to live life fully as a human. And so not only, and this I think one of the unique aspects of the Urantia book is that idea that not only was his life here a revelation of God to man, but also one of man to God. I don't know if that's helpful.
I love that. And I want to add something too, and that is that, you know, you mentioned man kind of falling away from God, and I think that's true. I think that it goes deeper than we know, and the Urantia book really explains how that happened. You know, like, for instance, I'll give you an example. The Course in Miracles talks about the error so great. The Urantia book tells us what the error so great is. It talks about, the Course talks about the separation from God. The Urantia book would tell us how we came to be separated from God. And, you know, that history is very insightful and very revealing for us, because the Urantia book says unequivocally there was no fall of man. Man never had to be ransomed or redeemed. But there was a betrayal of man, and man's knowledge of God was betrayed by a rebellion. And man has been, you know, in a way slighted and was not benefited with the knowledge. Yeah, on this planet at least, not benefited with the knowledge that other planets normally have about God. So our understanding of God was hampered from the get-go. And all of these revelations, including and especially Jesus, and the Urantia book describes the other major revelations that have happened to help us correct that deficit. And it claims to be one in a succession, and it says that there are others coming. And each one of these revelations, just like Jesus, requires a leap of faith on our part. Do we believe that God still talks to us? Do we believe that God has the power to reveal himself to us? Because if we do, then we should be open to that fact and be willing to entertain, perhaps, that's exactly what's happening. And the Urantia book further says that there are many kinds of revelations that come through to our world. There are those revelations that come through en masse, like the Urantia book. It calls itself an epical revelation. It's like a major revelation from the universe to us. But there are those revelations that come through from the inner life, through a prophet, for instance, or through a great person of God who is given to know something and reveals truth from within themselves. And the Urantia book calls those auto-revelations. And auto-revelations happen all the time. Epical revelations happen once in an epic, but auto-revelations happen constantly. And so God is reaching out to us in any and every way. And once you embrace this reality that God still speaks to us all, now you see God speaking in every possible way, through every possible means, to you, to all of us, to guide us toward love and peace and brotherhood and all of those great values that we have held up for ourselves forever. And you, Gumshoe had said, you know, put God first, and I would add one thing to that, put your brother next. That's Urantia book is saying, of course, put God first. It was never a question that God loved us. What we can't seem to learn as a planet is how to love one another. And once we get that right, this planet will change.
And especially, how do we love people, others, who don't believe the same things we believe. I think that for some reason that seems to be the largest, hugest challenge of all. I know hugest probably isn't a word, but bear with me. One of the wonderful things about this is that Jesus really taught us to fear not and to believe what he was telling us. He says, if it would not have been so, I would not have told you. And he tells us repeatedly to love our brothers. He doesn't say to the apostles, only love those who look at life or believe in God in the same way that you do. And he says, at another point, he tells the apostles, I never told you that I expected you to all think alike. So this difference in belief structure or belief system is probably one of the biggest things we're going to have to learn to get past in order to really facilitate this brotherhood of man.
Mm-hmm. So I hope that that answers some of your questions.
Yes.
And you're welcome to keep listening with us here. And we're going to, do you think we have enough time to read one more apostle? The next one is James Zebedee.
Sure.
Well, we haven't really had much chance to talk about Peter.
What do you want to say?
I have something I'd like to say.
Okay.
Go ahead.
In the second paragraph, it makes a mention of it, that Jesus did attach a new and significant name to Simon in a lightly bestowed nickname. And the nickname that he called him, and we recognize it as the word Peter, but in the, I think it's probably Greek, but it might be Hebrew or Aramaic. There's Cedes, spelled capital C-E-D-E-S, Cedes, which means rock. So Jesus was calling Peter Rocky. Now, that means something different today than it does. But this was something
to
that
a fisherman,
in the seminary,
what would that mean?
Anchor.
Yeah, right.
And today it means Hollywood has given us Rocky, and Rocky 2 and Rocky 10 and Rocky 1004. But, you know, that outstanding character who gets up when he falls down, and when he makes a mistake, he owns up to it. And so we always, that was always quite a little joke in the seminary. It was Rocky. And on this, Jesus said, I'll build my church or my community. I just wanted to add that little point.
Okay, great. You know, when we were at the Sea of Galilee, when I was there, I stood on the shores of Capernaum, probably right where David, where the Zebedee's boat shop was. And my friend Larry Geis found an ancient anchor. It was a rock with a hole hewn in it, and you could just see where they probably had tied a rope through that hole and used it as an anchor. So that's great. Thank you, Gumshoe. Peter was an anchor.
I also think it's really pretty profound that that Peter had such a he says he was sort of the greatest combination of courage and cowardice.
Mm-hmm.
I find that really quite moving. You know, he wasn't perfect, and yet he was able to do so much in spite of the fact that he had those moments of real undoing, so to speak. You know, one of the things that's so great about the way this paper is written is that it seems like we get to see the bright side and the dark side of various personality types.
Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by the comment, Peter was the first of Jesus' apostles to come forward to defend the work of Philip among the Samaritans. And thank you, Gumshoe, for your bit of history there. And Paul among the Gentiles. Yet later on, at Antioch, he reversed himself when confronted by ridiculing Judaizers, temporarily withdrawing from the Gentiles, only to bring down upon his head the fearless denunciation of Paul. That gives you a real insight into some of the dynamic that was going on between these two men, the one who had a direct and very real experience with Jesus, and the other who had an indirect experience. And, interesting that they were so passionate about reaching out to the Samaritans and the Gentiles. And the Peter we know, I think we could agree, would probably be the first to do that. And yet, when faced with ridicule, he reversed himself. So there's that same pattern, the same thing that caused him to deny the master in the courtyard. That same pattern.
It also, I think, really helps us to love Peter, to forgive Peter, to care about Peter, to understand him. To know that that was just one of his weaknesses of character.
Right. He didn't go sit well with ridicule. Andre, you've been pretty quiet. What do you think about?
Well, I've been interested in the discussion for one thing. There have been a lot of interesting points brought up. I always like to go back to what any of the apostles thought about Jesus or admired in Jesus. And it's interesting to consider that his tenderness was the one trait which Peter most admired, and that he never grew weary of contemplating Jesus' forbearance. Now, that's very, very interesting. In contemplating Jesus' forbearance, it seems that the apostles, and if they were given to contemplating the master at all, were in a sense growing toward God and in seeing God in the master. And that to me is an interesting aspect in looking at these qualities that they admired. So it really tells you something about Peter's tender-heartedness deep down, even though, he was one of the ones that advocated taking up the sword to defend Jesus when he was about to be betrayed. And you really get a view of the inside of the man. The other thing is, it's having heard a lot about martyrdom, it's easy to sort of almost take it as a given, knowing how the story ends. As a Catholic kid, I grew up hearing how the story ended for Peter, that he was crucified on the cross. And in Catholic lore, it's that he didn't feel worthy to be crucified right side up, so he has to be crucified upside down. Now, that's not corroborated in the Arantia book. At least it's not mentioned. But the interesting thing to me about all of that is that they do indicate that he considered it to be a high honor to be crucified as the master was. Now, to just reflect on that a moment, nobody likes to give up their life. The master, in the end, was still asking, Father, if there's a way to remove this cup. And by the time he received the answer to that prayer, he was okay with what he had to do. But I think about, Simon Peter, an apostle, and the amount of spiritual growth. We're told that after the Spirit of Truth descended at Pentecost, and everybody was experiencing that influence, how much more they grew than all the time they'd been with Jesus. An amazing statement in and of itself. But here you see in Simon Peter at the end how much he had grown, so much so that it was deemed an honor by him to die the way Jesus died. And I think about the transformation in a person's thinking and feeling that they can get to that point. I could not claim at this point in my life that I would be ready to die on the cross to end my life today for any good reason. I'm not saying that I wouldn't be. I don't think I'd feel very good about it yet at this point. I don't think I'm there.
Hope you won't ever have
just,
to.
Just being honest. Just being
well,
honest.
Well, you know, and I think, go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I'm just, and so not to belabor that point of death and dying and all of that for Simon Peter, but imagine the fortitude of character that really what you're seeing at that point in your life is you're seeing your connection to the universe that the Master talked about. You're seeing your relationship to God directly that the Master talked about, and you're living it. And you're living it so strongly that that reality is so much stronger in your heart and mind than what is about to happen to you on earth. That you really understand they're just giving you, you know, your way to the next life. That you are about to be sent in one way or the other closer to the presence of the Master. And to me that's just phenomenal that Peter got to that point in his life after all the work and all the work that he did to get there and all the service he performed on the way to that.
Can I bring up one quick point on
sure.
just what Andre was speaking? It's probably unlikely that Peter was crucified upside down. Crucifixion doesn't work unless it's the other way around. And chances are the Romans wouldn't have changed their system for a convicted criminal. The one thing that's interesting is that Paul was not crucified, and the reason for that was that Paul was a Roman citizen, and Roman citizens had certain legal rights, and one of them was that they would not be crucified. That's why Paul was beheaded in Rome, whereas Peter was not a Roman citizen and was therefore considered like a slave practically, and was therefore crucified. The other tradition is that his wife stood at the bottom of the cross exhorting him to continually preach the word, and I think in somewhere I read that his last words were, "Remember the Master, remember the Master," to her. So it's
wow.
just a really touching moment. And then she went on, and did some fabulous work. And then she was thrown into the wild beast.
Well, it says in this passage that we just read that while he was being crucified, she was being thrown to the beast.
So tradition has her just out there giving it to him, telling him, "Keep going, tell him." Tell them what's going on. Tell them about Jesus.
There was another apostle
that
said about. As we read on, we'll hear that. But two insights about Peter that you pointed out, Andre and Gumshoe, for me is that he went all the way from being fearful of being ridiculed to the ultimate ridicule, being crucified. That's really quite astonishing. You know, he went all the way. And his love of Jesus' tenderness and his never forgetting Jesus' admonishing them to forgive not only 7 times but 70 times and 7 would make perfect sense to me, because Peter, being the impetuous person that he was, probably said a lot of things he regretted in life, or did a lot of things he regretted, and cherished the thought that he could be forgiven. and of course cherished that he was forgiven and by Jesus. And you know, when I read the story of Peter and him being forgiven by the Master, you know how downcast he was after the denial, and he felt like an outsider. And then Jesus sent Mary to say, tell the apostles and Peter to make sure that Peter understood that he was forgiven. And it goes on to say how he burned so brightly after that, how once he realized that he was forgiven, he burned so brightly that he went on to win thousands for the kingdom. And I think of the Jesus' story about the debtor who had, you know, the landlord or the master who forgave two debtors, one a great debt and one a small debt, and who would love him more? Well, the one that was forgiven the large debt, the largest debt. And I think Peter was that person. He was forgiven a great debt, and so he gave a great deal back.
I think that also must have been especially true for him after what happened with Judas. I think that it must have been even more intensely, he must have been even more intensely ashamed than he would have been had things mm-hmm. not gone the way they had.
Good point.
You know, another thing to note here just in that is what a partnership Peter must have had with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
She's called variously Febronia or Perpetua. I think the Catholic Church names her as Perpetua, the rest of Christianity perhaps Febronia, and there may be other names. But the point being, to imagine the partnership that they had is just remarkable to me. I think it's unimaginable to most people, the possibilities in that kind of partnership. And just looking at how she was there to the very end and exhorting him and he exhorting her back, there's a lesson to all of us in that if we pay attention.
When the Master was in her home, he sat and talked to his apostles in her very home with her child sitting on his knee. You know, I mean, we sometimes forget that on the periphery of these great transactions between Jesus and his apostles were the women's corps and the children of the apostles and the children of the disciples and the wives of the disciples. And there was this ever-widening circle of influence. And wasn't she also on the women's corps? Wasn't she also?
I believe she was.
Yes,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you know, I had an epiphany once sitting at the kibbutz and on the Sea of Galilee, and Steve McIntosh was reading parables by the seaside, and in the background there were children playing, and here we were, you know, all sitting out listening to this robust young man read parables by the sea, and the children were playing in the background, and it was almost a deja vu I had. It was like, wow, this happened before. Their children played in the background as they sat and listened to the Master speak. Their children were not far away somewhere else. They were right there. And he had a profound influence on everybody that came into his circle. So it's wonderful to contemplate these things. And you know what? We're out of time.
We are.
So,
thank you for letting me talk more about Peter before we moved on to the next.
Well, we really didn't have enough time, and you know, if we have to carry this on a little longer, we got through 2.5, say, because of the prelude, but we'll try to get through them in 4 weeks. If not, then we'll keep going. Nothing.
Yeah, thank you so much for reading that so nicely, Chrislyn. That was just very nice.
Oh, yeah, beautiful.
My pleasure.
I don't know if you got to hear Gumshoe's history of the Samaritans and stuff before you came on, but it was really great.
No,
so
I didn't,
Gumshoe.
But I'll go back and listen. Thanks, Gumshoe.
Yeah, for that perspective, your historical perspective just really makes the story come alive even more so. So.
And
well,
thank you to our callers for joining us.
Yeah, call
yeah,
back.
Thank you.
Join us in this
series. I invite all our listeners to come and join me tomorrow at 11 Mountain Time and 1 Eastern. And tomorrow we're going to talk about the Beatitudes as the ordination service for these apostles.
Great,
and,
thank
that's
you.
Exactly what that meant. So, yeah, it's going to be a great show tomorrow.
Thanks.
Thank you
so
everyone.
Much for having
we're
me.
Done with Cosmic Citizen today.
Yeah, and we'll be back next week, and we'll be talking about John Zebedee and his brother, James, and so the Sons of Thunder. So we hope
Sons
you'll
of
join
thunder.
Us. So until then, we'll just say bye
Love
for
Love you
now.
All.
Love
Bye-bye.
You, too.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.